Welcome to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later, where we research the response of our past and review their relevance for today. This is your host, Moshe Kurtz. Welcome, my friends, to another episode of Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Today, we are joined by Rabbi Zachary Beer, and we are going to be looking at an iconic tshuva of the Ramah, perhaps one of the most iconic tshuvos of the Ramah. When we talk about tshuvos of the Ramah, and you say, oh, tshuva of the Ramah, the one about the Ramah, paskening that you can do a kiddushin, even once Shabbos has begun, with lots of asterisks under those circumstances. Now, Rabbi Zachary Beer is a chaver at the Ritz Gross Israel Kollel and a National Graduate Fellow. He is currently pursuing smicha and a degree at the Azrieli School of Jewish Education and Administration. Rabbi Beer co-authored the Haftorah Helper on OUTorah.org and served as an educational consultant for OU Relief Missions. He currently lives in Yerushalayim with his wife, Alex. Also, this episode is being dedicated to Lilei Nishmas Yitzchak Elimelech ben Akiva Zev by his family. May Hashem grant all of them continued strength and nechama. So, as I said, we are looking at perhaps one of the most iconic shuos of the Ramah. It happens to be, as I mentioned in a previous episode, by Hashgacha Pratis. The previous episode, we looked at Siman Kuf Chaf Dalid in the Ramah, and now we are proceeding to do Siman Kuf Chaf He. So, Rabbi Beer, maybe you could just tell us a little bit about the Ramah. In the previous episode, we deliberately didn't spend much time on the Ramah, about his bio, because I knew you had a lot to share about that. You could tell our listeners why you, Dafka, wanted to do a tshuva of the Ramah, and then we'll jump into the particulars of the tshuva.
Okay. So for myself, the reason why I'm so close to the Ramah is he's a personal hero of mine. Like, it's a little bit interesting. We all look up to Rishonim or Achronim. I don't know if many people describe people who have been dead for a couple hundred years as personal heroes. But for me, he exemplifies an anava and a care for Am Yisrael that is so important to me. And I think this is true from his biography. So the Ramah, unfortunately, did not live a very long life. He was born in 1530 in Krakow, where he lived his entire life. And he died a mere 42 years later on Lag BaOmer in 1572. So unfortunately, you know, he had a very productive life, produced many Sfarim, but not a very long life.
Yeah, it's a real musser whenever you hear about these Gedolei Hador, who they lived half the lifespan that people have today, and yet they put out much more than anyone does today. It's pretty remarkable.
Yes, yes. Well, I think as many of your listeners know, there's a famous place where the Ramah appears. He appears in the Shulchan Aruch, but this isn't the only thing he wrote. He didn't just write the Mapa on the Shulchan Aruch. He didn't just write the Darkei Moshe. He wrote multiple Sfarim on Halacha, Sfarim on Machshava. He was a philosopher and a Makubal, and he really just did a lot. And I guess going back to the Darkei Moshe, so he was actually writing the Darkei Moshe as this full, lengthy commentary on the tour, and you know, comes one day and he goes to his local Sfarim store, and there's this new Sefer app that came out on the tour by this guy from Sfat named Yosef Karo, who he never heard of his entire life, and he realizes, oh no, he did exactly what I wanted to do. And at that point, he completely rewrites the Darkei Moshe to be a commentary on the Beis Yosef instead of being its own thing. So we have the original, I guess what's called the Darkei Moshe Ha'aruch, I believe is the original Darkei Moshe. But the one that's, you know, if you're learning Torah, that's his rewritten version. So then a couple years pass, and he's running a Sefer Psak, and he goes into the Sfarim store again, and guess who's Sefer? He's in the Sfarim store a second time.
Can't catch a break.
Can't catch a break. And this Sefer Psak, which supposedly existed, we don't have anymore. He was gonazed as to, I guess, ensure that there wouldn't be extra machlokas for Am Yisrael. And for me, that's just very heroic. Like, I know many people who are have a lot of anava. I know a lot of people who are very holy people. I don't know even if those people could, you know, not just once but twice say, I'm going to totally sacrifice my legacy and my personality and all I want to do in the world just for Am Yisrael. So wow. For me, that's just so heroic, and it emphasizes what hopefully I want to do with my life. So
wow. And indeed, the Ramah's legacy, thank God, does actually live on. So maybe at the time it seemed that way, but perhaps Hashem orchestrated that his legacy would not be forgotten. Perhaps his schar is reward for his anava. Now, nonetheless, even though the Ramah seems like this really conciliatory kind of figure, he seems to not want to pick any fights with anyone. He wants to make good with Rav Yosef Cairo. Nonetheless, this tshuva we're about to look at, really, it starts off. He says, "Ve'eshmach right kol rash gadol." There's this great, all these rumors that are being spread about a psak that I gave. And I just want to contextualize for a moment. In the previous tshuva, in Kuf Chaf Dal, which is our previous episode, the Ramah is looking to justify the practices of other Jewish communities that seem to be under scrutiny and perhaps under halachic attack. And now here, he is the subject of those complaints, of that scrutiny, and he needs to defend his own halachic decision-making.
Yeah, it's totally weird. I've been describing this to some people, you know, who I'm friendly with, as this isn't really a tshuva. It's like a reverse tshuva. It's everybody's, you know, I don't have to answer your question. I have to answer everybody's question on me. He's just having to go out and defend himself. It's like a little bit
funny. Right. So what we're looking at is what we're going to look at in a moment is that the psak was already given. The maisa was makuyam, right? Everything was already done. And now he needs to send out this lengthy essay explaining and justifying what he did. So maybe you want to lay out for myself, our listeners, what exactly is this scenario that was so controversial for the Ramah?
Sure. So he explains at the beginning of the tshuva that there was this girl who was orphaned, and her family had set aside some money for her to get married, and she had family who didn't really want to help her out, but she found one relative who was willing to help her out. And after all this suffering and all this horribleness, she gets to her wedding day, and they're checking in the books, and there's a third of the dowry missing, even after all this minor help from her family that was set aside. Oh, yes. And the Chassan's family just does not want to go ahead with the wedding. And there's a back and forth and a back and forth and a back and forth. And, you know, they're trying to convince the guy, you know, don't embarrass a holy Jewish woman. And still he's refusing, you know, it keeps on going like that until it's Shabbos already, basically. Oh, and wow. And the Ramah is here and he's saying, well, if I, you know, push off the wedding, who knows what's going to happen? I can't give them more time to argue. I got to act now, and I got to go ahead with the wedding. And after that, he has to go back and say, well, how was that halakhically okay? Although I'm sure he knew in his mind at that point, we had to tell everybody else why that was halakhically okay.
Right. So this is like it's a really sad case. As you said, you have this young woman who was an orphan. She's taken by her family. Her family is supposed to help provide a nedunya. They don't really provide one in the end. And now the other side feels like they're being gypped. They don't know if they want to go through. And the clock keeps ticking in the meantime until it's actually Shabbos. And I guess the main halachic issue here is with the marriage taking place on Shabbos. Maybe you want to explain to us what is so problematic about that.
So it's a Mefurish Gemara that says, you know, lo mekachin on Shabbos. And according to the Pshat of the Gemara, according to many of the Rishonim, that means what it says, that it's just absolutely usher in all cases to do Kiddushin on Shabbos. But the Ramah, in the back of his mind, realizes, there's a Rabbeinu Tam that says, no, it just means a mekachin on Shabbos, except in the case where the guy hasn't been Mekayim Peruvu yet, where he doesn't have any kids. And he has to figure out, how am I going to justify Rabbeinu Tam here? And he goes through this whole thing saying, here's why Rabbein times are really justified. He has a whole, you know, he doesn't, Rashi is, I guess, representative of the majority position, and he has many questions on the pshat. And he eventually says that at the very least in this very Shasa Chak case, we can possibly like Rabbeinu Tam. But it's not his only problem.
Right. So we have this mission in Beitza, which is telling us all yes. these different kind of things you can't do on Shabbos and Yontif. One of them, which is, it's called the Rishus, is that you can't do Kiddushin on Shabbos. But perhaps the argument that he's quoting from Rabbeinu Tam is that it's only considered Rishus, it's only considered a voluntary act if you've already fulfilled Piria Verivia, if you've already fulfilled that mitzvah of reproducing. But if not, then actually this could be a mitzvah. And if it's a mitzvah, maybe it would be permissible to do on Shabbos. Is that the argument?
Yeah, that's essentially Rabbeinu Tam's argument. Or that's how Rabbeinu Tam reads the Gemara, and that's how the Ramah is going ahead with his argument.
But there is another issue, which I believe he brings up, yes. which is the issue of being Konek Kinyan B'Shabbos, right?
Yes. So there is the issue of people, you know, will say that, well, if maybe you're Kona her belongings with the chuppah. And he says, no, he rejects essentially that idea that it's not necessarily, you're certainly not being Kona her belongings. He, you know, and either way, in this case, we don't even hold, like, I guess he's his main issues with the smog, who seems to hold that way. So he says that, you know, this isn't the primary issue. So, and additionally, there's also Yerushalmi that seems to say similarly, and he notes that basically nobody postens like the Yerushalmi. So between those two issues, there's no issue of Kenyan at all.
Yeah. Well, if it's such a great argument, how come it caused so much controversy?
Because it goes against the pshat in Rashi and in the Mishnah. So, okay. Even if it's not a Kenyan, you know, it's still incredibly controversial.
So. Right. Though I think what makes this tshuva of the Ramah perhaps so famous is not just because of the reasoning that you just put forth for us, but it's the considerations that motivate this psak.
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. He brings a whole laundry list in the middle. I don't know how many you counted. I made a list of at least six.
So I think I may have only gotten three or four. Tell me if we line up. One was, he said it's a shasad chak in general.
Well, he didn't just say to shasad chak. I read it as it's like a super shasad chak. Like super, really, really right, bad.
She's going to be missed by Yeshes. This is going to humiliate this young woman. There's also Kavod Habrios, which I guess we could talk about it. Maybe that's one in the same thing. Mm-hmm. And then there's also some other issues about just preserving marriage, even if they are not yet married. So those were some of the things I picked up on. But you know what? You obviously did a lot more research than I did on this, Chuba. So why don't you break it down for us? What are the six different considerations?
So he also made a consideration that, let's say, even if we were able to push it off until after Shabbos, at least in the times of the Ramah, they considered Sunday really as the Yom Eid, as the holiday of the Christians. So it wouldn't just be one day pushing it off. You're pushing it off for 2 days. So that's one problem. And you mentioned the value of preserving the Shidduch. He also mentions that, and this is very interesting to me because I wonder if this is maybe true in our days, but he said that we're in Galus and there was very few Jews left anymore. And therefore, Bizman Azev, we're going to be Makil here because it's so important to produce more Jews.
Right. Bizman Azev, Anu Masei Ma'at, Anu Makilin. That's, well, there's, and you know, it's funny because I'm used to hearing that argumentation post-Holocaust, but I guess this is throughout Gullus, unfortunately, this has been a consideration in the back of the Jewish consciousness.
Yes, yes. He also mentions, which is one thing that's important to note, even in the light, even if you want to say like Rashi in the Mishnah, it would still only be an Isser Derabanan and wouldn't be an Isser Deraisa, which he also mentions here.
Well, to, you know, you learned in what, well, you're a Chris, but that's part of why you, I learned in why you, doesn't Rosh Hashanah always have to say, well, okay, we also keep Derabbanans as well. That's also part of the Torah.
A very good Rosh Hashanah impression. It's part of the Torah, but I think we all understand that even as much as we respect Chazal and we care about Derabbanans, you know, it's much worse to be mishtachbet l'avodah zara than it is to not listen to Megillah. So
okay, that's fair. That's fair. So right. So this is what are the other considerations that come in? Did we cover them?
Yeah, I think so he mentions additionally, and this is perhaps interesting for many of us, that he says one of the main issues here would be the fact that back in the day they actually wrote the ketuvahs there in the spot, and the Chassan wrote the ketuvah. But even though that was back in the day, that back in the day was before the Ramah. So the Ramah said, we're not experts in writing ketuvahs anymore.
Oh, and interesting. So the reason you shouldn't do Kiddush on Shabbos, maybe it's not because it's a concern of performing a Kinyan on Shabbos. We don't conceptualize it like that. But it's just a general geder. It's a concern that because there's documentation that needs to be written, maybe he would come to write it on Shabbos. But since that's not how things go anymore, he's not writing it himself. We don't have to worry about that. But, you know, this comes back to another Tosos, which I think is actually in that same area there, Beitza, which is about are you going to get this about the dancing and clapping on Shabbos?
Yes,
I walked right into that, didn't I?
Yes, you, or maybe you could say you danced right into that.
You know what? Rabbi Beer, why don't you tell us? Why don't you tell us what that Tosa says?
So Rabbeinu Tam says that even in his day and age, we weren't experts in repairing instruments, which is the main issue with clapping and dancing on Shabbos. So you're gonna, you know, play an instrument, and the instrument's gonna break, and you're gonna end up repairing it. So I guess unless you're a professional instrument repairer, then even as early as Rabbeinu Tam, you'd say you can clap, you can dance. And the Ramah seems to take this totally as a sad lahakel here. Although interesting to note, he's more machmir in the Mapa, in this commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. Right. So it's interesting here that he's willing to take this along as one of his studim lahakel. Although perhaps the Maisa, he would be more mock.
Right, because we have the issue that generally we go based on how the Rambam articulates it, that just because Batla Tam doesn't mean Batla Gezera, doesn't mean that just because the initial rationale is gone means that all of a sudden that Isser Durabanan fades and dissipates along with the rationale. That's usually how we assume things operate, which is weird. It's a little bit odd how we can then say that we can now have marriages and kiddushin performed on Shabbos just because the initial impetus for that gezeira no longer applies. Yet, as you point out, we have that Tosfos and Beitza there, which says, well, maybe that's how we see people dancing and clapping these days, because no one is really going to be repairing instruments to dance and clap on Karbach Shabbos, right?
Yes, which is, I asked my Rebbe, Rev Asaf Bednarsh, this question. You know, the Ramah seems to be very makel here. He seems to be less makel in the Shulchan Aruch. And he said, Lamaitza, perhaps back then there were just, you know, people running around with instruments all over the place, and you could clap and sing for secular instruments as much as as much as for mitzvah music. But for mitzvah music, certainly there's no problem to clap and to sing on Shabbos, although obviously I'm sure you know many people who do the classic backwards clap or the
other things like that. I do it begrudgingly. When I don't want to look like a Polish Schmidt at Seaboard, I do it begrudgingly.
Yes, I always do like a couple claps at the beginning of the song and then I stop, because then it's like, oh, everybody's like, oh, you know, the spirit got to him. And so it's totally fine. It's because he realized after a few seconds that he could stop.
Right. It's, you know, I'm kind of from, I generally don't even dance on weekdays. I might come to do it on Shabbos. It's a, everyone has to have their personal chumras. You know, yes, Revezer Schwartz, one of my rebbeim, was very mob. He's like, you know, you have to have some personal chumras. So that's my personal chumra. I don't dance during the week. I might come to do it on Shabbos.
Yes, I know. I went to the Gush for yeshiva, and our yeshiva's very famous for the Gush Shuffle. you know, that as long as you keep at least one foot on the ground, you're good in terms of Rika. So
right,
perhaps
I think
it's
Rishon Zalman has a svara like that. In that whole sugya about the issue of dancing on Shabbos and Yontif, you have to ask yourself, how do we define dancing? So right, if you keep one foot on the ground, arguably that's not the kind of Vildachaya kind of dancing that might be more problematic. I should mention for our listeners, we do have an upcoming episode on the topic in which the Minchas Elazar defends the practice of dancing on Shabbos and Yontif. So if this topic interests you, keep an eye out for it. But in the meantime, let's circle back to the Tshuva of the Ramah. So are there any other interesting points in his analysis that we should keep in mind?
I think certainly one point to make at the end is, even though he musters all these arguments, even he says, well, this is like a huge shas adchak, and you can only be somech on me in this shas adchak. And it's understandable. It's understandable that he cares so much about the situation. And that's actually something that I wanted to note, which is this Ramah did not only interest me, it also interested Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzadik Lebracha, who wrote his famous essay, Ma Enosh, on Judaism and humanism as a response to this tshuva. So the version I think is available online is not the full complete version, I believe. I don't remember specifically if you mentioned it on the version online, but I'm pretty sure. But in the new volume that Koren put out, Values in Halacha, he has a full translation that he did of this tshuva, as well as the full version of the essay where he specifically comments on this tshuva. And it's telling to me that Rav Lichtenstein, who was known for being so in tune to, you know, the needs of other people, for midos, for, you know, caring about the world, would look towards someone like the Ramah, who was willing to, I guess, throw down the halachic gauntlet and say, like, this is what I'm going to do. This is what's important. We care about other people. Obviously, we don't go against halacha, but we take all our chachma and all our abilities in halacha to try and care about people as much as we can.
Right. I assume Rav Lichtenstein is, he's riffing off the Kavod Habrios element of the tshuva. Is that what he's focusing on? Which I think is an important point. Whenever we bring in these, what we call meta halachic values, I think it's noteworthy. I don't think it's a chiddush really, but it's worth mentioning that it's not like the Ramah just said, oh, I see that there's this really complicated and really terrible situation in front of me. Well, now this young woman and this young man can get married on Shabbos because Kavod Habrios. Rather, it was, here is a halakhic analysis, and here is kind of like this more Das Yachid-oriented reading of it, and I think there is a halakhic basis, and then we use Kavod Habrios to tip the scales as a basis to rely on it in a Shas Adchak. It's not just like, Kavod Habrios, human dignity, okay, rest of halakha doesn't count anymore. That's not actually what the Ramah is doing. The Ramah is just using it as a sniff that is involved in his broader halachic arithmetic.
Yes, I would say it's a sniff, but it's also sort of the bow that ties the entire tshuva together.
It's right, I guess you'd say that was his main impetus. Like, he started off with, look, there's a huge Kavod Habrios issue here, and now I need to figure out how can... I guess it's also a funny question you have to ask yourself. I'm sure the Ramah is capable of doing this. Maybe over the past few hours, as this entire story was unraveling, the Ramah was thinking through all these considerations in his head. But now he had to kind of write it out for the rest of us.
Yes. You know, I could imagine, you know, he's running to the shul that's next to the hall, and, you know, opening up his Gemaras for a second just to recall, you know, all the little pieces, that just to be 100% sure. I would feel like maybe if I was in the Ramah's place, obviously I would not have the same chachma, but I would could imagine myself trying to figure out something on the fly, obviously not in the same way that the Ramah could.
Right. Something interesting. It's in the footnotes of the edition that I have. I'll throw them over here. You can see for those looking at the video, it's a little blurred out. It says here, V'ikiv harav milis spalo mayriv v'beis haknesses shalo ad shenigbar hadavar v'nasam kidushin. That he pushed off mayriv at his shul until this entire matter was done. This wasn't just like he was letting the family play it out on their end. He was doing everything he could to ensure that it was done properly, chedasu chedin, at the end of the day.
And by the way, speaking of his shul, if you've ever been to Krakow, or anybody who's ever been to Krakow has been to the famous Ramah synagogue there. So his shul, where he delayed Mariv, was actually established in memory of his first wife. So it's interesting that you bring that in, that the shul that sort of represents, I guess, the unfortunate lost marriage is something that's Ki'ilu a part of being able to establish another marriage.
That's I never thought of it that way. It's very poetic. And you know, speaking about the value of Piri Verivia, I think toward the end of the tshuva, he says, Da'afshir deshaidi mitzvah Piri Verivia, shehi mitzvah gedola. He says, it's not just simply that this is a mitzvah, but Piri Verivia is a supremely important mitzvah. Shein mochrim sefer Torah l'shum mitzvah ba'olam kim l'lilmo Torah lisa isha. The Gemara Megillah, Chav Zayin Ben Avi quotes, says, you can never sell sefer Torah save for two mitzvos, for Piri Verivia and for studying Torah. And it also, he quotes from the Gemara in Erevin, Dinei Nash Yeshua shall havi le ben debitel Yisrael mi Piri Verivia v'lenei shal shebitel karban atamid. Yeshua wasn't punished for the cessation of the karban atamid, but for Piri Verivia, he was. So something else to keep in mind, in addition to Kavod HaBrios, is just that this is a very important mitzvah. And if the Ramah could find some way to facilitate and ensure that this marriage actually is seen through to the end, then this is part of his motivation. And then one other thing I noticed at the end of the Shua, he says, nonetheless, V'yechola ha-mitzvah l'chaper lav im kavanos l'shem shemayim v'shalom. He gives a little bit of a blessing at the end. Hopefully this mitzvah should atone for any mistakes made as long as being done l'shem shemayim, which...
Yes, I also noted in the Mosada Rav Kook edition, it has a similar note at the beginning that, you know, that it should be mechaper if I made any mistakes, if I caught that. Ramah is clearly surrounding himself with a lot of, I'm just being careful. I'm just trying to do what's right. And Hashem should forgive me if I made any mistakes or I made any problems halachically.
Right. And I think you see his modesty play out, as you mentioned before at the beginning.
He says it multiple times. He says, well, I'm such an unav. I know I can't go against Rashi. I know I can't go against the smog. I know Lamaisa, he does. But, you know, at the very least, he acknowledges that there yesh misha gadol mimeni, and that I respect them, even if I need to disagree with them. And if I could just say, I guess, perhaps one last thing about the Ramah, I did what I think was a pretty thorough investigation of this issue, that we all know the Rambam's kever has mi Moshe on Moshe lo kam kamoshe. Mm-hmm. And there have been many other famous Moshes throughout history, you know, Moshe Feinstein, the Chasim Sofer, Moshe Sofer, even not Rabbi Moshes like Moshe Montefiore. And on none of their kfarim, aside from the Rambam, it says mi Moshe on Moshe, except for one person, the Ramah.
Huh.
And he's the only other person who I could see that on his kever it says Mimosha on Moshe.
Wow.
And for me, that's very representative. There's somebody who, of godless like Moshe Rabbeinu. And lo kam kamoshe, I'm Moda in all of Jewish history from the end of Chumash until the Rambam, nobody came like Moshe Rabbeinu. But I could say from Moshe, at the very least, from the times of the Rambam until the Ramah, there is nobody of such godless and such importance and of such care for the Jewish people as the Ramah.
So, absolutely.
And that's why he's my hero.
Well, and you know, we might need to take it up with the editorial committee for tombstones, but absolutely. I think your point is very well taken. When we think about just Rabbanim who have had influence on Jewish practice within the past few hundred years, there is no doubt objectively that the Ramah has been one of the most pivotal and critical figures in ensuring the continuity of our Masorah, particularly of Ashkenazic Masorah, of course. And so I want to thank you, Rabbi Beer, for really sharing this profile on the Ramah, sharing this very important Shuvah of the Ramah. And God willing, Hashem should bless you and your family, that you should only have nechama, much strength, and God should make you matzliach in all of your limudim.
Yes, and the schus of the Ramah should defend all of Am Yisrael just as he would want them to be protected.
Amen. Thank you for listening to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Please make sure to subscribe to get the latest updates. And if you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to rate us and leave a review. Do you have a response to the response that you want to share on the show? Please send your letter to the editor to MitchellMKurtz@gmail.com. And God willing, we would love to consider your perspective to be shared on a future episode. This is Moshe Kurtz, and I look forward to reviewing more responses with you next time on Shoot First, Ask Questions Later.